So, coming out of our last 2 days and yesterday's sessions, any themes, motifs, questions people would like to voice? Question.
How to be fully integrated. I had a dream not too long ago where I met myself. So we happened to see each other. And then I was in an apartment. I had some difficulty getting on the light and walking through the room. I wasn't at all afraid. I saw a woman standing there. And I said, well, who are you and what are you doing here?
Yeah.
And we recognized each other. And we hugged each other. We were happy to see each other. And then like little children, we wrapped with our arms around each other's waist and our heads against each other. And then I said, well, from now on, I'll always try to take you with me wherever I go.
Yeah.
And even as I said that, so I could feel this person kind of like cardboard figure going to crumble up.
Wonderful.
And I felt it, so I'm just wondering if all these different parts of us are supposed to keep them separated.
Yeah.
Be strong either on their own or what.
That's perfect for this morning. Question is, do we have to be integrated? And, I stand here as a living example of not being integrated and trying to work it that way. But, and in the dream of meeting a young girl who was part of yourself in the room.
My reflection.
Your reflection.
Yeah. But then enough moonlight was coming through and I said, oh, it's you.
Yeah.
And she said,
it's you.
And we hugged each other and we happy to see each other.
Okay. So let's work with that a little bit this morning. Okay.
There is. Well, there was. It's probably gone. Selected poems of Marina Tsvetaeva.
Yes, it's a wonderful blue cover with a picture of domes. You can order it again through Judith. So I recommend it to everyone. It's a marvelous collection. But what is it particularly about that poem? What is it particularly about that poem, Hugh? Yeah. What is this gypsy passion for separation?
Yeah.
Yes, this willingness to rush off when we've just met. My head rests in my hands as I realize, looking into night, that no one turning over our letters. You see, that's genius, that line. An ordinary poet would just go straight to the thought. But she says, but no one turning over our letters has yet to understand how completely and deeply faithless we are, which is to say how true we are to ourselves. How true we are to ourselves. Yeah. We need a wee bit more sound. Can you bring the volume just to the point before the echo? But yeah. Oh, lost. Do you mean the poem or the experience? The book is out of print. But you can get it from libraries, and it's David Wagoner, as in someone who drives a wagon, Wagoner. And it's in a book called Who Shall Be the Sun? Who Shall Be the Sun? It's the sun in the sky. It refers to a creation story of the Northwest Indians, and all the animals were vying to see who would be the sun. Salmon Boy is also in that. But I haven't recited Salmon Boy yet, have I? No, I haven't. Yes, I will. I will. Am I following my bliss? And how did I make the transition from a marine zoologist? By the way, it says in the brochure that I was a marine engineer, but I was not. I was a marine zoologist, studied animal life, but also plant life while I was there, too. But how did I make the transition? Actually, getting that job for Galapagos was a moment of revelation in my own life, because when I was a child, I wrote poetry all the time. Poetry has always been one of my great loves, my central love, probably. But as a child, I also watched Jacques Cousteau on the television, those early programs, the early equivalent of Discovery, the Discovery Channel, and had this great yearn to go out and be a marine zoologist in the Pacific and study all these marvelous animals. And so, to the great grief of my English master, my classics teacher, and my art teacher, I chose at 16 to go into sciences, because in Britain you specialized very early. You basically chose your major at university when you were 16 years old. So I chose to do biology, chemistry, and physics, which was hard for me. It was much harder, but in a way I did it because I always knew I could pick up a book of Shelley or Keats or Wordsworth or Dostoevsky, and I could read it, but I would not be able to pick up a book on ecological genetics without some kind of training, and I wanted that other side. You know, so at that point, I was following a bliss, but as my friend Michael Mead says, you know, the root of the word bliss comes from the same root as the French word blessure, which is wound. So you're not only following what is ostensibly a joy, but it's also a place which is, it's a place where you're open to the world, or you want to be open to the world. The wounded part of you is the place that's literally broken open to the world, where there's some possibility of exchange. And I felt some kind of beckoning uncertainty there that was calling me. As it turned out, by the time I got to graduate from University College of North Wales in Bangor, it turned out that every third member of my generation had also been watching Jacques Cousteau. And they were all graduating at the same time. And so there was this huge bust in the life sciences field, whereas 5 years before you could get a lectureship in a university almost out of your undergraduate courses. There were no jobs to be seen, and people were papering the walls with refusals from interviews. They weren't even getting the interviews. And so I had made this vow in the middle of the year that I was not going to waste my time applying for a job, and I was going to go off to India. During my university vacations, I used to travel around Europe, and I would pick grapes, pick tomatoes, paint hotels, work on fishing boats, do all kinds of things. And I also used to play I used to play Irish fiddle on the streets of Germany and Switzerland and Holland, and make huge amounts of money for that time, and would live the life of a kind of vagabond king around various cities in Germany. And so I'd vowed that I was going to go off to Germany, I was going to have a great summer there, and see some of my old friends, the old cities I love, play a lot of music, make a lot of money, and go to India. I didn't know why, I was just going to go there. So I'd made this vow, you see. And it's interesting, because Peggy was talking, she mentioned a story I had told when we had the preparation day for this conference with the executive committee here. And I had told this story about how when I was a child, we had all these clocks in the house, one of which my father used. He was English. In fact, he was Yorkshire, which is a kind of pragmatic Midwest of England. And where a spade is a spade. When you tell a story, a spade is a spade. The Yorkshire method of telling stories is to repeat the same story day after day, week after week. And somehow it's just as interesting each time. I don't know how exactly. I must have picked it up somewhere. But the Irish method is that the story changes each time. You know, my mother would tell a story when she was 7 years old, and I'd say, wait a minute. There's a donkey in this story now. There wasn't one before. She'd say, oh, no, there's a donkey there, all right. The story would change every time. And you realize the two different ways of viewing the world. One was that things were just so, and then the others were things were just so depending on what you wanted to say. And that the spirit of the story was much more important. That was what was true in an Irish story, was the spirit of the story. whereas the details were true in New Yorkshire, and both had their own kind of truth. So my father had one clock which told Greenwich Mean Time exactly. And my mother had probably 6 or 7 different clocks in the house, each one for a different task. If you wanted to catch the bus down at Savills Arms, then it was 10 minutes fast. If you wanted to catch the bus over the back by the Robin, it would be 5 minutes fast. Then she had a clock to get up by, a clock to go to bed by. All of these clocks were attempt to gain advantage over fortune. So I lived in this house where these two worlds collided, and I think I became a poet in a kind of last ditch attempt to try and find out what this was, to reconcile this. But so I'd made this vow. So the Yorkshire side of me had made this vow. You see, I was not going to apply for a job. And then suddenly, late one night, in the little Welsh village in which I lived, outside of the university town, I walked through the rain-swept streets, and we were working on our finals then. And they have this wonderful system in English universities where, for your final examination, you get examined on everything you have studied in the last 3 years. None of this continuous assessment way of dealing with things. And so we'd been working for months, 10 or 12 hours a day. And so it got late at night, and I could not study anymore. I thought the best thing to do to solve my conscience is to disturb someone else. So I went round through the streets and called on a friend of mine. And she would not be disturbed. She was calling from the other room. She said, "Put the kettle on, make yourself a cup of tea," and I'm working. And then I looked on this table, and there was this application form for a guide for Galapagos, to be a naturalist guide in the Galapagos Islands. And I had seen this advertisement in Nature magazine, which is a prestigious kind of research magazine. And it had a beautiful picture of a 3-masted schooner, and it was the advertisement in the volume. And when I looked at it, I said, there must be 500 people going for that job. I said, I'm glad I've made this vow. But here was this application form, and I called her. I said, "Are you going to fill this in?" And she said, "No, I've decided that being a woman in South America for 2 years, I'm not going to go for it after all." And so I thought, "Would you mind if I fill it in?" And I said to myself, with what I would put if I was going for the job, which I wasn't going to. I was going off to India. So I filled it in, and having all this excess energy from this day of studying, I filled in everything, including all the margins. All kinds of wiseacre comments and stories and faces and drawings, and I filled the whole thing in. And then there was a coal fire going there, and I stared into the coal fire, and suddenly Galapagos began to take shape. It almost appeared out of these flames. And I felt this other Irish side of me saying, "Now, what does a vow really mean?" And so I called to this woman, and I said, "Listen," I said, "you have to do something for me." And she said, "What?" I said, "I can't apply for this job, so you have to get the envelope, address it, put the stamp on, and send it off. So you apply for the job for me. I won't apply for it, you go for it." And sure enough, she did. And sure enough, I got an interview place. And there were 90 people got interviews out of 500. Sure enough, there were 500 people. And when I got down to the place, which was this wonderful old Lords of the Admiralty Inn on an inlet in Kent, Faversham, and got into the interview, I found that all the things that I had done out of sheer love, such as rock climbing and traveling around Europe and picking up languages just by accident and camping in the mountains and diving, which was a very strange thing to do in our marine zoology department. The professors didn't actually feel that you needed to go down there, to get wet. Something I'm British about that, but I'd taken up diving, and And so all these things fitted together, and as I sat there in this interview, I had a sudden intuition that I had the job, and that it was. And I also had a sudden revelation that that this was you know, in some ways the deeper revelation was that I had followed my bliss. Which had often been a wound in some ways, because in following things, you're often going against the strictures that of society or family or university, academia, whatever it is. And it's almost as if you're trying to push these things in and there's something wrong with you for doing it. You know what I mean? And at that moment, I made another vow, which was that I would always follow those inclinations, because at some time along the line, and we do not know where, they would be called on. And that there was a deeper faith in that. And it, in fact, you know, in Galapagos, Galapagos was the place where I really feel I served an apprenticeship in poetry. Because in Galapagos, I learned how to pay attention. I didn't really know about the phenomenology of attention or the spectrum of attention that you travel along until I got to Galapagos. When I first got there, I would take people ashore after we'd done our training. We'd have a group of people wherever they were from. They could be from Italy or Germany or North America or Peru or South Africa or Australians, whatever they were. We'd take them ashore, and I would be round the island in an hour and back on the boat. And the crew on board the big boat were trying to get the place clean. They would say, "What are you doing back already?" You know? I'd say, "Well, we've seen it." You know, so within a very few months, they'd be sounding the ship's horn to get us back on board, because we had only traveled 50 yards from the dock, and we were still looking at something that was still fascinating us. And I was able to hold that attention and bring people in the group into that attention. And the spectrum of attention looks something like this to me. First of all, you have the stage where there's no attention, which is what I call the black hole stage. And you know these great black holes out in space, where the gravity field is so strong that not even light escapes from them. You know those days you have, where the preoccupation with the petty concerns of the self are so strong, that gravity field is so strong that nothing escapes. You can only see the world through the lens of one's own complaints. Or the lens of one's own self-pity in some ways. Or the realm, or the lens of one's own strategies in the world. So nothing escapes, not even light. Second stage is where you simply notice something outside of yourself. Now this is the great part, the great teaching of Galapagos, is that Galapagos is such an extraordinary place. That there was always something which was taking you out of yourself. You were forced to look. You'd be walking along the path complaining to yourself about how the crew had stolen your shoes again and you could not find them. And suddenly a hawk would fly down and land on a branch just a few feet away from you, literally 3 feet away from you, and stare at you blinking. There was this continuing revelation. Now, the next stage is where you start to pay real attention to that. Say we'd be walking along that path on the way to the flamingos, the Flamingo Lagoon. So you're paying attention, you're quiet now, you're watching, you're ready. But still you're wanting something from the world. There's still a part of you. For instance, as a guide, I would want to maybe shuffle a little too close to flamingos, because if one or two of them took off, the people would see these beautiful black under feathers under their wings, which you wouldn't see if they were just feeding. And so there's this little part of me edging too close to disturb one of them. So you go through that, and then you can pay real attention. And suddenly, it's as if a strange kind of space starts to open up around the flamingo as you're watching it. It's the only way you can describe it. A quietness, a silence. It's almost as if the flamingo grows, perhaps not in size, but in prescience, in presence. So, noticing turns into attention. And at this point, I would say that attention turns into praise. Praise is where you have no investment in what you are paying attention to. You're giving this tremendous attention. And then the fiery place and the place where you step over is where, in a very strange way, the flamingo starts to praise you back.
You're suddenly revealed
to yourself in that praise that returns. Very disturbing moment, because the person who began the process is not equal to this moment. And the door of initiation at this point has to do with dying, but also with a kind of self-forgiveness and compassion, self-compassion. That's what I want to work with this morning. And eventually one gets to the point which is spoken about in all the great contemplative traditions, Zen, Western Catholicism, Quakerism, where you drop away and the flamingo drops away, and what you have is the relationship between you.
I heard a physicist say that the smallest particle they will ever find is relationship.
And you feel this at this moment, that what's alive is the suchness of your relationship with the flamingo, or with whatever you're looking at, or with the suchness of the person you are, of the relationship between you and the person you are with. If you've ever been in the presence of very holy people, this is what I feel we feel, is the holiness of what we feel, is that they are so present that whenever you change, they are so in touch with that live wire which is between you, that they can be there for the change that occurs. Simply the relationship, and it's as if the energy is pirouetting backwards and forwards like a tightrope walker between the two of you. So, having gone to the bottom of the lake with to wrestle with Grendel's mother yesterday, I'd like to work with the process of dying this morning a little. And living again through self-forgiveness and compassion. Sorry, then.
How was that?
A little better?
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, I wouldn't. Actually, I'd like us just to stay with that image, because I think it's quite clear from the image. And sometimes when you don't get an image, just staying with the image itself, I feel, is the strongest one. It's there. If you feel that's a real one for you, that's a kind of koan. The images of great creativity turned demonic. Yeah. See, we got that word demonic. There was another word which was diamond, D-A-E-M-O-N. It's an old phrase, an ancient phrase, which meant an angel come to earth. And I think there are two sides to any demon image, which is the demonic side and then the daimonic side, both of which are difficult to deal with because they're presences of immensities which are much larger than we can carry at any one time. talking of an immensity which is too great for us to carry at any one time, the immensity of death is an enormous one. And I was very moved by Anna Morris's sharing this morning about going over. And I felt, I was reminded about in that moment of the last breath, it's almost as if it's a moment of tremendous self-forgiveness, too, at the same time. As if in order to cross over, there is some part of you, there are many parts of us that we must accept. And in that acceptance comes the forgiveness that allows a kind of graceful becoming, a graceful crossing over. You hear this again. In poem after poem, where you get this feeling of memory I was talking about yesterday and the day before. You know, the Greeks said that memory is the mother of the muses. Meaning that, you know, the arts and the inspiration of the arts came from this memory of what, almost a genetic memory of what it means to be alive. And to be able to die into that life. And that there are parts of us which we have not accepted to such a degree that they're either in the corners of our room, our internal soul room, or they're out in the hallway, or they're even out in the street, and down alleyways with nothing to eat and they're freezing to death. There are parts of us we will not bring back in because they're too scary. So there comes a time when you have to greet yourself, in the words of the poet Derek Walcott, arriving at your own door. This comes out of Pearl's image here. There's a poem by Derek Walcott, West Indian poet, where he says, Derek Walcott normally writes these long, alliterative epics, but one day he must have grown tired of himself, and he sat down and he wrote this one-page poem. And he said, the day will come, when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome, saying, sit here, eat, you will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes, peel your own image from the mirror, sit, feast on your life. Feast on your life. The day will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome, saying, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes, peel your own image from the mirror, sit, feast on your life. In Matthew Fox's work, the way he emphasizes again and again the amount of feasting that took place in Jesus' life. This image again of feasting. That no matter the pains of the world, there's a place for feasting on the world. Feasting in the world. The world asks you to eat it in a way, in all its various forms, to smell it, to feel it, to touch it. Walcott intuits that the way through is this inviting back in of these parts that have been disowned.
meeting yourself, arriving at your own door, in your own mirror,
saying, sit here, eat, you will love again the stranger who was yourself.
In some ways, the guardian to the door of that temple,
the guardian to the door of that temple is exactly the same, doing exactly the same.
What about this part?
The part we've disowned, which we've turned into the demonic aspect, and which we've had no corroboration of in our life to bring back in, to invite back in. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf. I love this line. See, the poet goes to the deep privacy, finds all these love letters there, and suddenly says it, and then everyone says, wait a minute, how do you know they're there? How did you know I had those? Some of us have them in, for some of us, they're up there in just a huge pile falling off the shelf. Others of us have them color-coded, A to Z by decade. But for every one of us, they're there. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Feast on your life. Here you get the same internal image. I was talking about the monocultures we have out in our agricultural world. And then the strictures we put on our own diet, where the diet is the way we will eat life. We say, I will only eat cornflakes, or I am rice, I am wheat, I'm just this. And the whole feast is waiting there for us.
Waiting to kind of meld with it.
Marvelous poem by one of our great contemporary poets, Mary Oliver, who had a terrible childhood, terribly abused childhood, and survived it. And this poem tells you how she greeted that part of herself again at her own door and was able to feast on her life. But here you feel in this poem the way she never loses attention to the world. As the poet goes inside her own body into her own well of grief, she never loses attention to the magnificence of the world. She's feasting all the way down. And sure, she is saved from being kind of tugged into that black hole of self where the only referent for the world is yourself and its success in it. And it's called the wild geese. She says, marvelous first line, she says, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. Feel like she knows the territory here? Familiar with the place. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. But meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the soft pebbles of rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over again, announcing your place in the family of things.